Okay. So here we are finally after my computer booted twice and installed updates in between. Sorry for that. I finally made it. So what we will speak about today is modeling. And I already gave a very, very brief introduction on how to represent triangle meshes, for instance. In the introduction of that lecture, because obviously you need some models in order to be able to render them. And today we want to look into that further. We will look at different representation of triangle meshes and stuff like that. What's the goal? You already, or most of you did programming exercises, so you know the problem well. Before you can render a scene, you need some description of the objects. And the typical way we do that is using triangle meshes. There are other ways. So for instance, in the upper left, what you can see is a volumetric data set. This does not have surfaces. Instead, it's a kind of three-dimensional texture that stores transparency values as they are typically come out of a computed tomography machine or things like that. But the typical way, or a very often used way to render such volumetric objects is again to transfer them or to transform them to some geometry, to some surface that you can render. And now these objects can be quite simple as those on the lower left, or they can be much more complicated like the ones on the right. They can be really modeled, or they can be generated by a scanner or whatsoever. In the very first computer graphics demos, people typically used very simple objects like a cube, a cylinder, or I think on the right, that's an icosahedron. So yeah, these are very simple objects in the sense that they can be described using a few parameters. A cube, for instance, can be described only by its side length, or a cylinder by the radius and its height, and the icosahedron just by the radius of the bounding sphere, for instance. So they are, very, very simple to describe. But of course, we want to have something general. And what we use for that is, as I already said, typically is triangle meshes. At least at some point, most of these objects are transformed to triangle meshes and then rendered. But before, there can be something else, like for instance, for this engine hood here of the car, or also for the famous teapot, these models have not been rendered as triangle meshes. The description of these surfaces is something more complicated. It's a mathematical polynomial description of the surface, for instance. But nevertheless, at some point, these are transformed to triangle meshes, which are then rendered. Yeah? That's the typical way to do rendering, is to transform everything to triangle meshes and render these, because this is well understood and can easily be done. What we typically have are surfaces. That means if I want to describe this table here, for instance, I only describe its surface, and I typically don't have information about its interior. Yeah? And this doesn't matter because we cannot see the interior. typically, that also means that for many of these objects, we at least have information what is inside and what is outside. Yeah, so for such a surface here, we typically know that, looking from this side, we see this face. Yeah, we look on top of this face, and on the back side, there's something solid, and we cannot go into that part. Yeah? So we typically have something, information like inside, outside. This is not always the case. Probably some of you know at least the object on the lower left. That's the so-called Möbius strip. And that's just a, yeah, I don't have. don't know what this is. Okay. So what you can do is that you take such a strip, and if you shape it like this, you get a ring. But if you rotate it once, yeah, you get this Möbius strip here. And this one has an interesting property, and that is that you cannot really define something like inside, outside, or a front face or a back face. Yeah, because if you, I forgot my laser pointer. So let's say for some reason you say, okay, this is the front face. Yeah. Now you go along this front face here, and suddenly you end up on the back side. Yeah. So this surface does not have an orientation. It does not have a front face or a back face. Okay, that's a little bit a weird case, yeah, and it's a kind of counterexample what we typically do not want to have. The Klein bottle is a rather famous example for the same thing like the Möbius strip, but this one is really a closed surface, so it doesn't have a boundary like the Möbius strip. And yeah, Klein is the one, Felix Klein, I already think I told you about. Our new building is named after him, so he's a famous, also Erlangen mathematician. And he invented that weird surface. Here it's exactly the same, like with a Möbius strip. Yeah, if you start at some point, and then you walk along the surface, and you walk and walk and walk, and suddenly you end up at the same point, but on the inside. Yeah, so it's again a face that cannot be oriented. It has this... here, self-penetration, that's necessary for such surfaces in 3D. Okay, good. So that's not the important point for today. It's just to characterize such surfaces. More important for our purposes is probably the distinction between surfaces that have a boundary or that are open and closed surfaces. So if you take just a single triangle, this triangle obviously has a boundary. Yeah. So you have the edges of the triangle are not connected to anything else. Yeah. So you have an open object, an open surface. Yeah. You can look at that surface from both sides and see something. More realistic, typically, are closed surfaces. So closed surfaces means there's a solid object, and you just describe the surface of the solid object. So this has a clear inside and outside. So these closed surfaces don't have a boundary, yeah, and which is for many algorithms an important assumption, yeah, and yeah, you can see examples here. Yeah, so these really have a clear inside and outside. They're just the surface, the boundary of a solid object. As I said, for some algorithms, that's important. So for instance, for some algorithm, it's important that if you model a wall in a house, yeah, you should not only model the wall as a single polygon, yeah, because then you have one polygon and you can look at it from both sides, but instead really have a wall with a finite extent, yeah, so you have one face here and one face here, and in between it's kind of solid, yeah, and for several algorithms that's just important. We will see that later on. Okay, so that's the ideal thing, such a closed surface, and then there are other cases that we also should avoid, and these are non-manifold surfaces. So this is an example here in the bottom. This surface is critical, because here this edge here has three neighbors. Yeah, that's again something which is sort of weird, and there are algorithms that just won't work with such surfaces. We will also see that why this is the case. Okay, and yeah, such non-manifold surfaces are in fact something that happens quite often. So there are many different situations where this can happen. So for instance here, this is a plate here, a disk, and this cylinder is just attached. That means it lies on top of that plate. And that's also a non-manifold surface. Yeah, it's exactly like this one here in the bottom. And yeah, this happens very regularly if humans design such objects and they just don't care. And it's very often it's really a mess to get such objects and just to work on them until they fulfill all these typical requirements that we have, that they are closed surface and manifold surfaces and so on. Okay, that's just a kind of warning. Okay, so today what we will speak about now is first modeling single objects. So we will always consider little objects, bunnies or whatever you have, small objects, single surfaces, with different methods to model them. And then we will, in the second part, we will speak about if we now have single such objects, how can we combine them to large scenes. Yeah, this will bring us to scene graphs and stuff like that. And in this lecture, for surfaces, we will focus on polygon meshes. Yeah, these are by far the most widely used ones. There are several other ways, parametric surfaces. I will give a very little brief view into that. This is then further handled in the lecture geometric modeling. But there are still other possibilities, constructive solid geometry, for instance, that's widely used in mechanical engineering. That means you construct your objects using Boolean operations on simple primitives. So you start with a cube and then you drill a hole by intersecting it with a cylinder and stuff like that. Yeah, that's again another problem. Subdivision surfaces are also handled in geometric modeling. It's a very modern way to represent curved surfaces, for instance, also in games and in movies and procedural models. That's a shader that describes reflection of light. Yeah? Something similar can be used to describe geometry. It's a kind of building procedure for geometry that can generate trees or stuff like that, buildings. Okay, good. But for now, we will look into polygonal meshes. So that's here an example of a surface. And in that particular example, the surface is not in the original data. Is not a polygon mesh, even if it looks like that. But in fact, it's a very, very dense point cloud. So it's generated using a laser scanner that samples the surface, that finds 3D positions on the surface, and all the find points on the surface are then written to a file. And we get 381 million points, single points that lie on the surface. Yeah. They are not yet connected to triangles or similar. They are just rendered as points, but they are so dense that in the result they look like a closed surface. Also these representations first are transformed to polygons before they can be rendered. Yeah. So polygons. As I already said, are the modeling primitive in computer graphics. This has a good reason. Almost everything can be turned into polygons. We know good procedures, very optimized procedures to render polygons. On polygon meshes, we know how to perform certain operations, things like smoothing objects, for instance, mesh operations, deforming such objects. This is done in computer animation, and so on. So it's a very convenient primitive to work on. Memory and disk space is cheap. That means for several objects, there might be more memory efficient ways to store these objects, like for instance a sphere. Yeah, this can be very easily represented by the center and the radius. So representing that as 10,000 triangles, as a mesh with 10,000 triangles, is wasteful. That's true, but nevertheless, it's advantageous. Yeah, if we have just a very simple primitive and we represent everything with that one. Okay, so polygons. I think you know these slides, so I showed the first two or so I already showed in the introduction of this lecture. Polygons are an ordered set of vertices, so P0 to P5 in this example, and typically we assume that they lie on a common plane, that they are planar, because otherwise it's not clearly defined how the in-between surface looks like. And there are certain constraints. So for instance, they should not overlap like we see here in the lower left, but they should be well formed. And in a minute, we will also see what this means. And a polygon mesh now is a collection of such polygons with certain restrictions. Yeah, and that means not overlapping like we see here. Okay. So if the underlying polygons are all triangles, that's the kind of lowest number of vertices for a polygon that makes sense, then we speak about triangle meshes. And if they're all quadrilaterals, we speak about quad meshes. Quad meshes are also widely used. They're typically used in simulation, for instance, and other areas. So that's also another typical primitive. Okay, and I also already spoke about that we have to distinguish between the topology and the geometry of a mesh. So the geometry of such a mesh is just the 3D position of the vertices, and the topology is how these vertices are now connected to single triangles and altogether to the entire mesh. And I think you also know this slide, or also showed that one. So here on the left, we see two meshes. They have obviously different geometry because the position of the vertices are different, but the topology is the same. So we can, if we move that vertex to here and this vertex to here, yeah, we can, just by moving the vertices, we can deform this mesh to this one, yeah? How they are connected to triangles is exactly the same. Whereas for the two meshes on the right, the geometry is the same, but not the topology. Yeah? The position of the vertices is the same, but they are connected differently. So the left two are topologically equivalent, and the right one are geometrically equivalent. OK, so now let's a little bit further look into this topology thing, yeah, and also, as I said in the beginning, try to define rules, how we have further restrictions typically on how these triangle meshes should look like. Yeah. And to look into this, the first thing we need is a definition of triangulation. That's a concept that appears very often. And the idea is the following. So given a set of points, Vi, we can say a triangulation of these points consists of, so we have vertices, Vi, and now we connect these vertices with edges. So these edges are just pairs of points, and further a set of faces, so that's triple of points. I think that's quite obvious. And so that means, we have vertices. These are connected. And so these are the edges. And here we have triangles. So this is triangle 0, 1, 2. 0, 2, 3, and 0, 3, 4. And in fact, we should, yeah, that's a bit. Of course, if every edge of one of these triangles or the set of edges is the set of the edges of all these triangles. I'm just wondering why this doesn't stand here. So maybe we sort of forgot that. Sorry. Okay, so this triangulation, this is exactly the topology. Yeah, how are these triangles connected? How are the vertices connected to triangles? And based on this topology, we can now define neighborhood. Two vertices are neighbors, exactly if they are connected by an edge, for instance. That's obvious. We can say that two edges that share a vertex, like this one and this one, they are not neighbors. In this case, we say they are adjacent. Also, two triangles that share an edge are adjacent. So this one is adjacent to this one. And what else do we have? Triangles sharing. Ah, okay. Yeah. So okay, now I'm again, I mean, the last one I would call neighboring. Triangles sharing an edge. Okay, so so these two triangles are called neighbors, and these two are called adjacent. Yeah, they share a vertex, but they are not really neighbors. Okay, good. So, that's kind of how topology can be described as a triangulation. And now we can define some constraints on this triangulation so that it's a surface that we can well use for rendering. And this is what we then call a manifold triangulation. And now these are a number of restrictions that are rather easy to understand, I think, but it's well worth to have a look at them. And the idea now is the following. So let's just look at cases that we want to avoid. So one thing that we, for instance, would like to avoid is the following. We have such a triangle, and then we have another triangle. So that's V0, V1, V2. And then we have another triangle that looks like this. Yeah? And V3 is in the plane of the other three. So essentially, we just have overlapping triangles that are on top of each other. This is something that we want to avoid. And a good reason for that is that, for instance, if we render them with a set buffer, the result, what we get when we render these objects, depends on the order, because the set buffer cannot distinguish these two. Yeah. So essentially, the one will survive that is rendered first or last, depending on what you do with equal values in the set buffer. Yeah? So these are just objects that are not distinguishable, and we would like to avoid them. Another problem, or the other ones we will see in a minute. Yeah? So to avoid this, we have this first rule. The intersection of two triangles is either it's empty or a common vertex or a common edge. So two triangles can either be completely separate, or if they are closer together, they can share an edge, like here, or they can share a vertex, like here, but not more. Yeah. So here, the intersection would be a complete triangle. This also disallows things like this here, this example we had before, yeah, where triangles really intersect each other in more than only an edge or a vertex. Okay, then for edges, we also have a constraint, and this constraint is that every edge should only have one adjacent triangle or two adjacent triangles, but not more. So this disallows, this disallows the one here on the bottom, because here this edge in the middle has three neighbors, and it is clear that that if your surface describes a closed surface, then such cases should not be allowed. Yeah, it should always, every edge can have two neighbors, ideally two neighbors, and if it only has one, two adjacent triangles, and if it only has one, it's a boundary edge. Yeah, so here obviously the surface is open and it's not a closed surface anymore. So what this means is, if an edge has only one adjacent triangle, then it's a boundary edge, then we don't have a closed surface anymore. And if it has two, and if every edge has two adjacent triangles, then we have a closed surface. Yeah, it's not open, we don't have a boundary, it's really closed. And if one edge has more than two triangles, then we have this weird constellation, this is not valid. And in fact, we will have data structures that explicitly disallow them, that really only allow one edge to have two adjacent triangles. Okay, and so the last one we will also immediately see. So here these are examples. Maybe just here in the bottom. So what is disallowed? So this is this example here that I showed here. Yeah, overlapping triangles. This is not allowed. Another thing. That's now another property that is also not allowed for manifold surfaces. So with our current rules, this one here would be allowed. So you have four triangles and they share this vertex, but it's this vertex is sort of special, because it intersects two boundaries. We have this boundary here, and here we have this boundary. Yeah, so it's a kind of a single point where two surfaces are connected. And this is also something that is not allowed, which makes it not a manifold. So maybe I should just so manifolds are a mathematical description, are a mathematical term, and the idea of a 2D manifold is that you can kind of take a piece of paper and deform it, so let's assume you can stretch it as you wish. Yeah, you can do anything with it, but you cannot tear it apart. Yeah, and now you take this paper and you stretch it, and such a mesh is a manifold if you can stretch the paper such that it represents that polygon mesh. Yeah, and if you have a situation like this one, this would mean that you really have to shrink this to zero width, so this is not allowed. That was a bad explanation. But this manifold means that locally, Okay, let's put it like that way. Yeah, locally, at every point, you are either you have a closed surface around you or you're at a boundary. Yeah, so if I'm somewhere in here, yeah, if I look at a little neighborhood, I just have a closed surface around me. Now here, or if I'm here, yeah, I'm living on a boundary. That means I can go into this direction locally. I have a closed surface, and here I have a boundary. Yeah, so if I go over this boundary, I'm off my surface. So here, I have the weird situation that here I have a closed surface, and here I have a closed surface, and here I have a boundary, and here I have a boundary. So this is also, this is a special situation, and this typically also is not allowed. And this is restricted by the slower lines. So, and this is in a triangle mesh, this is defined as follows. If we look at a vertex, and we look at the adjacent, so let's take this one. We look at the adjacent triangles, yeah, that's these two. Then these triangles form what we call an open fan. That means they all can be ordered like a fan, yeah, a Fächer. And it's open in the sense that the last triangle is not adjacent to the first one again. Yeah. So, and if a first vertex lies on an open fan, then it's a boundary vertex. So a counterexample, we have to extend that one. That vertex here, the neighboring triangles, they form a fan, but this one is closed. Yeah. So the last vertex of every of these fans is the last triangle is connected with the first one. So for that reason, this one, yeah, is an inner vertex. And here, this one is a boundary vertex because this fan is open. Yeah. Here we have a boundary, and the fan starts with that boundary and it ends with that boundary. So these are the two situations that are allowed for a vertex. Yeah? The adjacent triangles are either an open fan or a closed fan. And this one here, yeah, we have two open fans. This one, then it stops, and then a new one starts, which again stops. Yeah? And yeah, we will see that there are data structures that rely on this, that we only have one open fan and that cannot represent such situations. Okay, I think it's better to argument with this than with a manifold thing. Okay, yeah. So this is what we demand now. Yeah. Triangles should not overlap like this. Every edge only has one or two neighboring triangles or adjacent triangles. And for every vertex, the adjacent triangles form either an open or a closed fan. Okay, so these are counterexamples. And yeah, how can we now render such, how can we represent such meshes? So, as we will see, there are different data structures to store these. You know one, that's the shared vertex data structure. That's a very simple one. In fact, that's one that also would, that has no problems also allowing such cases, yeah, and all non-manifold cases it can represent. It has the big advantage that it's quite simple, and it's for rendering purposes, typically it's completely sufficient if you only want to render these triangle meshes. But of course, there are other things you want to do with your triangle meshes, and for these, there are other data structures which we will learn today, winged edge, half edge, directed edge, and so on, that allow more operations. Yeah, and so it's important to know what you want to do with that mesh in your application. So if you only want to render, just store the object somehow and throw them to the screen, then shared vertex is fine. But there are quickly applications where you need more information, where, for instance, if you render one triangle, you want to have information about your neighboring triangles, for instance, in order to smoother interpolate values or stuff like that. And if this is the case, then your shared vertex data structure will immediately prove to be very inefficient. Yeah? In a shared vertex data structure, to find the neighbor for this triangle is very complicated. Essentially, you have to iterate over all triangles and see whether they share one edge. Yeah? So as soon as you need some more information about your neighborhood, and so on, about your surrounding, then you need more complicated data structures. And these applications can be modifications of the meshes, smoothing meshes, maybe simple animations on the meshes, better interpolation of attributes, and stuff like that. Okay. Good. The aim can be rendering, but it can also be geometric operations, queries of the neighborhood. And if we only look at rendering, there are certain things, for instance, only to compute normals. Yeah? Just to compute the normal of that point, what we need for rendering quite often, is that we need to iterate over all the adjacent triangles, compute their normals, and average them. Yeah, and doing that in an indexed phase set on the fly is not very simple. Okay, so even in rendering we need that, but even more for geometric operations. We have typical queries to the mesh that can become quite complicated, like, for instance, just give me for one vertex all the adjacent faces, or for a given face, give me the three neighbors, or however many they are. Yeah? Or for a given face, give me the neighbor over edge one, or give me all direct neighbors of a particular face, or all adjacent faces for a given face, and stuff like that. Yeah, such queries are needed there regularly. And so that's also one thing that is to be considered. And we will also see there are operations on meshes that even change topology. So if we have a very complex mesh, consisting of a million polygons, for instance, and we look at that mesh from a large distance, typically we say these 1 million vertices are way too much. Yeah, that's it's in the final image, it only covers a few pixels, so we can we render much more information than we can see. So one way to handle that is just to take a simplified version of that mesh. Yeah, to simplify the mesh if it's further away and we cannot see detail anyhow. And this simplification can happen by different operations. We won't go too into detail for that, but a typical operation is that such an edge here is collapsed. That means it is just removed. I think I start a new image. Okay, and this mesh now is simplified by taking such edges and removing them, replacing them by a single point. So the mesh afterwards looks like this. And also this point is drawn here. So it's, you see, it's a lot of changes that need to be done. So, and of course, not only one of these edge collapses is necessary, but to have a mesh with millions of triangles, you need millions of such edge collapses to get something significantly coarsened. So that means this operation of an edge collapse needs to be quickly possible in that mesh data structure. Yeah, you need to be able to say, okay, Now I want to remove this edge and quickly update the topology, yeah, with a few operations so that, again, I have a consistent mesh description. And that can really become complicated. Yeah? So try that with an indexed phase set, and you will see that's hell. Yeah? Just to collapse one edge, you essentially have to iterate over the entire triangle mesh. Yeah, so that's these operations. Yeah, remove a vertex, edge, or element, and also go back to add them again, and so on. Good. Okay, now, that's just examples what we might want to do on these meshes. Now, the typical data structure that you know, the simplest data structure that one can imagine now is the following, that we say a vertex is just the three coordinates of that vertex, and every triangle is three of these vertices. Yeah? So that's very wasteful because it doesn't consider that two triangles can share vertices. Yeah? So if this vertex appears for this triangle and for this triangle, the coordinates of that vertex are stored twice. Yeah? They are stored with this triangle and with this triangle. And even worse, with that data structure, it's very, very difficult to find neighboring information. Because now to find that these triangles are neighbors, you really have to compare all the coordinates. Yeah? This means also you have to make a comparison on float values, which is always critical. You will need some epsilon to be sure that you really find all connections and stuff like that. So this is a very wasteful data structure. It's typically called a polygon soup because you have lots of polygons and they are not connected somehow. Yeah? They are just flying around in memory without any connection information. Much better, or already much better, is shared vertex. That's the data structure that you typically use. And so the idea of shared vertices or shared vertex data structure is that the geometry is stored in a list. So you have a list where for every vertex, x, y, and z is stored. And x1, y1, z1, and so forth. And then an additional list stores for every triangle three indices of the vertex. Yeah? So in that example, it could be 3, 0, 3, 4. That's triangle number 1. And then 0, 1, 2, and so forth. Next triangle, and so forth. Yeah? So we have to handle two different lists. So that's a bit less convenient than for these triangles. That's only one list, but nevertheless, it's much more compact. And at least to find out whether two triangles share a vertex, we just have to compare indices, yeah, which are integers. So that's much better already. Okay, so that's what we already did before, and maybe another little remark. So essentially, such a shared vertex data structure is very widely used, but there are data formats that only allow to write data in such a manner. Yeah. So this output format only contains a line for every triangle, and in this line, there's the XYZ coordinate of the first vertex, then XYZ of the second, and then XYZ of the third. Yeah? So many coordinates are there multiple times, so these files are huge. And another problem, if you want to read them in, yeah, you get such a data structure here. And just to transform this to a shared vertex data structure is already quite some work. Yeah? You really have to find whether a vertex already appeared previously, and so on, and have to map them to indices and stuff like that. Yeah, so such data structures are quite painful, but they exist, and they are still used. Yeah, so that's far away from optimal. Okay, but shared vertex is by far not the most sophisticated format. For many purposes, it's just okay, but as soon as you're interested in your neighborhood, you need more complicated things. These we will look into now. So again, shared vertex or indexed face sets. That's essentially it's exactly the same. Yeah, shared vertex and indexed face sets are two different words for the same thing. And we have two lists. Okay, this one, you know this example, we already saw that. And in the introduction, I think I don't have to say much about that anymore. And now the interesting thing, or now one might think, okay, now if I'm interested in neighborhood information, I can simply extend this list. Yeah. So what I could do is that instead of only storing indices of my triangles, where am I here? Yeah, these left three are always the same as we had here before. Okay, it's a different mesh, so they're not exactly the same. And additionally, now we add indices to every triangle. So this is triangle 0, 1, 2. It's that one, 0, 1, 2. It's triangle 0. And now we also store information about the neighbors of these triangles. Yeah? So triangle 1 is a neighbor of T0. So here we see neighbor 1. Yeah? And the other two are boundary edges. So the other two neighbors get a minus 1 here. Yeah? That's a kind of null pointer. It says there's no neighbor. Now, ideally, there's also an order in these. So typically, this one is the neighbor opposite. So the first one here is the neighbor opposite to the first vertex. So triangle 1 is the neighbor opposite to this vertex. Yeah. So let me see. Here we have an example. Yeah. So here, 3, 5, 2. 3, 5, 2. Here, the neighbor opposite to 3, that's the first vertex in the list, is minus 1. Yeah, so there's no neighbor here. So there's an order here in this list. And this now allows us to find neighbors. And essentially, this already includes one of these assumptions on manifolds that we had before. Because this automatically says every triangle can only have one neighbor, can only have one neighbor over a particular edge. So if you have this situation, would cannot be represented in that. Yeah, because over this edge, it's not a triangle, but this face has two neighbors, this one and this one. Yeah. So that would make it necessary for us here not to really store a single index, but to be able to store a list. Yeah, and that would make things much more complicated. So every triangle only has one neighbor over a particular edge. Yeah. Okay, good. That gives us some neighboring information. So with this, we are sort of able to go through the mesh, but nevertheless, to find neighbors, but nevertheless, this enhanced face list still is not very complete. So very simple queries like, for instance, for a particular vertex, give me all the neighboring triangles, are still complicated, yeah? Because if we have a particular vertex given, we still have to go through the entire list of triangles and find one triangle that contains this vertex. And if we have so, we can always look for the neighbors of the triangles and then iterate through this fan until we come back again. But even this iteration is difficult because for this triangle, essentially we have to look at all three triangles, at all neighboring triangles, see whether they share this vertex, and only if they do, we go into this direction, yeah? And we only always have to go to the right direction, and so on, yeah? Writing such code is quite nasty. It's not nice. Okay, as a little side remark, there is a quite important or often used data structure for triangle meshes, which now does not solve the problem of how neighborhood is represented, but it fits well right here, because it's a kind of way to exploit neighborhood to store these meshes more compactly. And these are called triangle strips. And the idea of a triangle strip is the following. So look at what you can see in the lower right is a triangle strip. And a triangle strip is defined as follows. It always has a starting triangle, P1, P0, and P2. And now a new triangle is added, and it always shares the last edge of the first triangle. So our first triangle has vertices P0, P1, P2. Now P1 and P2 are immediately used as the first points of the next triangle, and a new point P3 is added. So a new point P3 is added. This forms this triangle. Now P2 and P3 are used automatically for an edge for the next triangle. P3 and P4 are again used for the next triangle, and so forth. So essentially, this means that by defining this sequence of points, P0, P1, P2, P3, P4, P5, and so forth, yeah, we can define this complete strip, a complete strip of connected triangles. And if you look at this list, we don't need to provide any topology information. Yeah, this is implicitly given by the knowledge that these vertices form a triangle strip. So triangle strips are essentially a way to define connected strips of triangles without any topology information. We can describe large chunks of geometry using such triangle strips. And now the problem is, if we have a large mesh given, and we want to render that using triangle strips, we have to make some pre-process and make this large mesh a set of such triangle strips. Yeah, so a large mesh is given, and now we say, okay, we want to represent that as triangle strips. Then we really have to find strips that small number of strips that cover this entire triangle. That's a very complicated problem. It's called stripification, and there are tools to do that, and there are interesting methods to do that, but they require quite some pre-processing. But the advantage is, once you have this stripification, it's quite compact to store the information, because you don't need any topology anymore. Yeah, you just store, okay, this strip, and then this strip, and then this strip. And another point, such triangle strips, it's no longer that much the case. They were supported very well by older graphics hardware, so that they could be rendered particularly fast. Yeah, so it's a kind of old school way to represent geometry, but it's still often enough used. Okay, yeah, so that's a triangle strip, and then there's a similar construct, which is called the triangle fan. This has exactly, or the idea is very similar. Again, given is a stream of vertices P1 to whatever, Pn. But now these triangles are connected in a different way. So the first vertex, P0, is always used, and the other vertices, describe vertices here that span a fan around this vertex. Yeah. Okay, so this is what we call a fan, and yeah, that's it. There's nothing very special about that. It's again a way, yeah, to say we have this list of points, and it's a kind of pattern to connect them, to define the topology, to connect these points. Okay, and an alternative are so-called quad strips. Quad strips, I mean, the meaning becomes clear, I think, if we look at this image. It's essentially the same like a triangle strip, but now for quads. If we have that sequence, then these rules here can be used to connect them to quads. So these quad strips, triangle fans, and triangle strips are kind of ways to define topology in old school OpenGL. So OpenGL in the beginning only allowed these triangle strips, quad strips, and triangle fans to sort of define topology. There was nothing like an indexed phase set or whatsoever. And this was the only way to, for instance, support things like, let's say here at vertex P5, yeah? Or I better go back to that triangle strip. Here at vertex P3, any lighting computation that is done is used for three triangles, yeah? For three surrounding adjacent triangles. Now, of course, if you have such a strip, you only have to do the lighting computation once for P3 and can reuse them for that for all the other triangles. Yeah. This is the kind of way using such triangle strips to support that in OpenGL. Today, with the indexed phase set, that works differently. I won't go much into detail on that. We speak about that in interactive computer graphics, but just these terms, triangle strip, triangle fan, and so on, are still widely used, and they are the kind of old school way to define topology. Okay, but yeah, they are also sort of outdated. And now let's go to the other direction. Yeah, what can we do? What is more sophisticated than indexed phase sets? And the first widely used data structure in that direction is the so-called winged edge data structure. It was presented in 1975, so already quite some time ago. And the idea can maybe best be shown here. So, it's less complicated than it looks like. So the idea is the following, that the data structure is mainly based on edges. Yeah, not so much on triangles, but on edges. And for every edge, now we store the starting vertex and the end vertex. Yeah, I mean, that's quite obvious. Now we also store information about adjacency. So the first thing that is stored is information about the two triangles that are adjacent. Yeah. So again, only two are allowed, and the first one is the one that is on the left if we go from start to end, and the other one is the one that's on the right if we go from start to end. Yeah. Furthermore, we kind of connect all the edges. And so for every edge, what is stored is if we go from start to end, at the end point, the first edge that goes to the right is stored. The first one that goes to the left is stored. So there's no further here or no further here. Yeah. It's It's really this one and this one, and the same for the beginning. This edge and this edge is stored. That's why it's called winged edge, because it looks a little bit like wings, yeah, of a whatever, butterfly maybe. Yeah, so it's mainly information about where the edges is stored. So here is now a little bit more textual description of that. So for every, so that's this edge table here. Yeah, for every edge, we store start and end vertex, start and end edge when traversing left face, start and end edge when traversing right face, and neighboring faces. Furthermore, for every vertex, the coordinates are stored, and one adjacent edge, and then we have a face table, which contains one of the incident edges. Okay, so that sounds complicated, but now we can make a little try and try to make some queries. So for instance, let's say we have one triangle given. And we want to find its neighbor. Yeah, the neighboring triangle. Okay, so for every triangle, we know one of its incident edges. Yeah, that's the face table here in the at the bottom. So for each of these, so for this triangle, let's say this edge here is stored. It's one of the three. We don't know which one. One of them is stored. Okay, now we see that this edge, we can look into the neighboring triangle list and we see, or no, okay, we want to find all neighbors of that triangle. Let's put it like that. Let's make this query. Okay, so we take the first edge, and every edge stores the triangle to its right and to its left. Yeah, so one is the one we started with, the other one is the first neighbor. Done. Then for this edge, we look. We proceed here. Yeah, we say, okay, we go from start to end. Our face is the one on the right, so the next edge we consider is E start right. So this must be this edge. From this edge, again, we take look at the two faces, get this one, done. Then again, we take the next edge, yeah, we get this face, done. Then we take the next edge and we see, okay, that was the edge we started with, so problem solved, yeah? So, yeah, it's with some thinking, it is possible to extract all necessary information from this data structure so that we can really iterate over the neighborhood. And very similar ways are possible, for instance, to find all triangles surrounding a particular vertex, for instance. Yeah, so first for the vertex, we are looking for the first edge. Yeah, this gives us this new end vertex. And for this edge, now we go at the bottom. Yeah, we look at E start left, for instance. This gives us this edge, this vertex, this edge, this vertex, and so forth. Yeah, so we can proceed through the entire mesh. Okay, good. So that was possible, but it's still rather wasteful. So these tables are quite big. Yeah? So if you imagine for every edge, we have to store start vertex, end vertex, start edge, left face, start edge, right face, end edge, left face, end edge, right, end edge, right face, neighboring faces, that's 8 indices per edge. Yeah? And additional information per vertex and so on. So that's quite a lot. And this can be, again, significantly reduced by storing a data structure which is called half-edge data structure. And this, in fact, is a data structure that is still quite often used. And the idea here is the following. We split the information per edge to two half-edges. So, what does that mean? So, in the winged edge data structure, what we stored is essentially this. This looks like, okay. But this is symmetric, yeah. So for this edge, we always have here left, right, left, right, left, right, yeah. What we can do now is that we store all information on the right of this edge as one entity, which we call half edge, and all on the other side, yeah, we store in another half edge. Both together give us all information about the entire edge, yeah, but now we have kind of smaller entities, and yeah, you will see that this a little bit weird concept in the beginning really makes things a little bit easier because we can handle orientation better. In the current or in the winged edge data structure, there's always the problem that you always have an explicit start and end edge, vertex. Yeah. So if in many of these or several of these queries, yeah, let's say you are here at this point and you want to get to here, to the other side of the edge, you first have to query, am I the start point? If yes, go to the end. But if you are here and you want to travel along the edge and you're the end point, then you have to go to the start edge. So there's always this this distinction in between. For the half-edge data structure, now this looks like this. For every edge, or for every, an edge between two points is separated to two half edges. The first one, so let's say that's edge V0 to V1. So the first one stores necessary information in this direction, and the other one stores it into this direction. Yeah. Every half edge stores its starting point, yeah, so this half edge stores V0, this one stores V1, and every half edge stores a pointer to its other half edge. And essentially that's already all. that sounds a little bit surprising, but you will see that this is sufficient. In the end, this will be sufficient. Now, to explain things, what every half edge also stores is a pointer to the next edge on the same face. Yeah. So this half edge here clearly belongs to this triangle. Yeah. And now, with every half edge, we can store a pointer to the same. So the half edge that forms the same triangle, yeah? So this is a kind of next pointer. Yeah, and three successive half edges, if we have a triangle mesh, three successive half edges form a triangle. Good, so this now can be shown or is shown here. So this half edge, has one neighbor. This is stored as this pair pointer. It also has a vertex. So in that case, it's the end vertex, but it doesn't make a difference. So I said the starting vertex, but you can also store the end vertex. That doesn't make a big difference. And it stores a pointer to the next and maybe also to the previous one. So this gives us this edge table, yeah? So every edge, and these edges are half edges now, yeah? Every half edge contains the end vertex, the opposite oriented half edge, so the other half edge. The adjacent face, I forgot that, yeah? So which triangle it belongs to, and a next edge, which can also be extended including previous edge, but this is typically not necessary. And for every vertex now, we only need one of incident half edge, and for every face we only need one incident edge. And yeah, this is how this will look like, this data structure. It still contains quite a lot of information, but yeah, we will see that all this can collapse, and for simple triangle meshes, most of this can be removed again. Okay, so now let's look at how can we do certain queries now. Let's again say what we want to do is find all neighbors of this triangle, direct neighbors. Yeah? So for every triangle, we know one edge, one half edge. Yeah? So let's say this one. Okay, for this half edge, we can find the neighboring half edge. So that's this one. And the triangle to which this belongs is the first neighbor. Done. Okay, so that's solved. Yeah? Then for this half edge, we take the next edge. That's this one. We again get the neighbor. That's this one. This one belongs to a triangle. Done. Again, we get the next edge, neighbor, triangle. Done. That's it. Yeah? And now you see we don't have any if or whatever. Yeah? It's just, yeah, you can directly write that down with a few lines of code. Yeah? With e.next.pair.next whatever. Yeah? And can directly enumerate all these neighbors. Or let's say I want to find all triangles or the fan around a particular vertex. Yeah? So for every vertex, I can find one edge that is incident, or it stores one edge that is incident. Let's say this one. Yeah? This one knows a triangle or belongs to a triangle, so we have that one. Now we take this edge, take the next, and the pair. Yeah? This again belongs to a triangle, found. Next, pair, found. Next, pair, found, and so forth. Yeah? And we can immediately iterate through that until we end up with the first half edge that we had. And that's it. And if we end up at a point that, if we are at the boundary, then once there will be a half edge that has no neighbor. So, yeah, all these queries become very simple. Yeah, and we have almost all necessary information, and all these queries become O of one. However large your mesh is, finding all these neighbors works pretty fast. So here, such examples as I just explained them. So this, for instance, iterates over all edges around a vertex, and you say the iteration just always jumps from edge to edge. Yeah, using this one edge pair next. Yeah, that's so you have this edge, and now to get the next one, you go edge next pair. Yeah, so that's the next one. Next pair gives you this one. Next pair gives you this one, and so forth. Yeah, it's once you get used to this idea a little bit, yeah, it turns out that things become quite simple. There is one thing: if the vertex is on a boundary, yeah, and we start. And the first incident edge, for instance, is this one, and you iterate, you end at the boundary, then we need a special case, because here we also have to go into the other direction. Yeah, if we cannot rely that by just going in a circle, we end up here again. Here we need a special case. But I think this can even be solved by defining if we are on a boundary, then the first half edge stored with a vertex must be the boundary edge that points to this vertex, and then we can immediately go around all these. Yeah, okay, but that's very special already. Okay, now this half-edge data structure requires all these restrictions that we spoke about in the beginning. Obviously, every edge may only have two neighboring triangles, because yeah, otherwise we would need three half edges. Yeah. So that's not possible. What is also disallowed is this one. Because with this, it's no longer possible to iterate over all neighboring triangles, because let's say we find this triangle and then this triangle, but we never get from here to here. Yeah? Because we only have one incident half edge for this vertex, and we will never find this part here. But that was a restriction that we also disallowed. Okay. Good. One thing that is also, but this is a bit more subtle, what is also disallowed is these non-orientable surfaces. Maybe you remember that Möbius strip. This one has the problem that you can start at some point, but in the end you will get two half edges that face into the same direction. Yeah, that's also a problem that this data structure cannot handle. The winged edge data structure can. And non-manifold surfaces are also not handled by half-edge and by winged-edge, but shared vertex data structure can essentially handle everything. Okay, and now there's a simple optimization. As I said, this half-edge data structure can be collapsed down very far if we know that we only handle triangle meshes. And now here the idea is the following. Now essentially everything that we store with every half edge, and this is this edge list here on the right, everything we store with every half edge is the beginning vertex. Now it's the beginning vertex, but as I said, this really is not a fundamental issue. And the pointer to the neighbor, yeah? To the neighboring edge. And now we have, of course, information is missing. So the first one is, what is the next edge? And here now the idea is that always three successive half edges form a triangle. So 0, 1, and 2, they form a triangle. Yeah? So the next edge can always be achieved by adding 1 with modulo 3. Yeah? So from here, we know the next one goes here, then the next one goes here, and then the next one is not here because this is the next triangle. Here we go back again. So that's a very simple operation with modulo. So the next pointer is implicitly stored by the order of the edges. So let's look at triangle 0. Triangle 0 has this half edge, and this half edge. And we have to store them in this order. We first have to store this, and then this. And this half edge starts at vertex 0, and it has no pair, no opponent. This one starts at vertex 1, and it has a pair edge, yeah, which will come later on. This will have index 5. 2 starts at 2. And again, it's a boundary edge, so it has no pair edge. Yeah. And now for each of these edges, we know the neighbor, yeah, is the next one in this triple. And because always three successive half edges form a triangle, yeah, we know that just by simple division of by 3, we can compute the triangle number. Yeah, because always three successive form a triangle, we just divide by 3 if we have an index for an edge, and this directly gives us the triangle number. So all information is stored in these two simple indices. Yeah, and we can continue now with the next triangle. This is this one. This contains of half edges 3, 4, and 5. Yeah, 3, no, this direction now, 3, 4, and 5. And yeah, 5 is the one that is common with 1, that has 1 as pair edge. And 4 has an X because this is not defined here yet. Yeah, and so forth. And yeah, now it's not too difficult. For instance, now let's say we want to find for triangle, for this triangle, for triangle number one, we want to find all neighbors. So triangle one means the corresponding edges are 3, 4, and 5. Yeah, that's 3i, 3i plus 1, and 3i plus 2. And for each of these half edges, we look at the neighboring half edges. That's 8, x, and 1. And just by dividing these by 3, we get the corresponding neighbors. Yeah, 8 over 3 is 2. So this is triangle 2 is this neighbor. 1 over 3 is 0. So triangle 0 is this neighbor. Yeah, and x over 3 would give us the index of this triangle. Yeah, so now really everything becomes neat and nice and simple. But it only works for triangle meshes, of course. It only works if we always know that it's always 3 successive half edges. Okay, so that's a very nice, very compact way to store all this information, to allow traversing the mesh in a nice way, and so forth. And essentially, this part here, by the way, is the indexed face set, yeah, because this is just the start vertices. So if we take this as indexed face set buffer, we can directly render it, and all the information about neighborhood is stored here, yeah, in a very convenient and easy to traverse manner. Okay, thanks a lot so much for today, and we will see you again on Thursday. Thank you.